Really great pleasure to be at this festive occasion with Gary. I've known Gary also as long as Bob Wald has. I had all these things to say, but Jim said half of them, and Bob Wald said the other half of them. But the work that I'm going to discuss today, I chose this topic because, quote unquote, when the earth was young, and long, long ago, Gary worked on these kinds of problems before he got lured into string theory. And so I hope that he can. So it's really a lot of stuff that, as you will see in a minute, that Gary contributed, made seminal contributions early on. Okay. So basically, I mean, in research in general relativity falls into these two broad categories. There is cosmology, and there is a study of isolated systems. So this study of isolated systems, and we know a lot of things about them, and they've been around for, these things have been understood for a long time. Particularly for the theory of gravitational waves, we need the notion of isolated systems. I just want to say that early on, there was a lot of confusion about gravitational waves. Einstein, of course, had this first paper on gravitational waves already in 1916. This was in the context of linearized gravity. But then in 1936, he decided that somehow gravitational waves don't exist in full general relativity, wrote this famous or not so famous letter to Born, saying that he has shown this, that somehow linearized theory was actually misleading, and so on. And of course, we all know that Eddington has also said that gravitational waves don't exist. They travel at the speed of thought. And the reason for this all confusion is really this diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity. And because of these coordinate transformations, things that look like waves could be transformed away, and so on. So it really was in the Bondi framework in the 90s to 80s that these ideas became very, very well established. And I think Andy already referred to the Bondi-Meissner-Sachs group. So what we have up here is an isolated system, such as a star, which is emitting gravitational waves going out to infinity up here. And what we can look at is really null infinity. And at null infinity, we have got this symmetry group. And the symmetry group is has the same structure as the Poincaré group in the asymptotically flat case, which is, but except that the Poincaré group has translations with the semi-direct product Lorentz group. And now we have got an infinite dimensional enlargement of the group of translations, the super translations. And in gravitational radiation, we can characterize it completely invariantly. And this was not how Bondi did it, but it was later realized that what one can do is we got this null boundary up here, which is scry, and then given any conformal completion, you have got a derivative operator that induces a certain connection on null surfaces, and the conformally invariant part of the curvature of that connection is really this Bondi-induced tensor, which exists here on scry. And if you want to say that there is no incoming radiation on scry minus, so that you are only interested in the radiation produced by the isolated system, then we are naturally led to ask that the new tensor be equal to zero. And there is a balance law for Bondi energy. And given any cross-section of scry, we have a two-sphere integral, which gives us the Bondi for momentum, if you like, but in the case of time translations, you'll give Bondi energy. And it was Gary who actually showed with did a lot of very interesting papers with when he was a postdoc with Paul Todd and then Malcolm Perry, that this Bondi energy is actually positive. And the difference between them is actually given by the new tensor squared. And if it is time translation, this function, which characterizes them, is positive. Therefore, we see that gravitational waves carry positive energy. And they're real, and as Bondi put them, you can boil water with them. Since Bob just mentioned about this beautiful structure of Hamiltonian, the Lagrangians, and then from there, a covariant phase space, very symplectic structure, and so on, this formula can be actually obtained by looking at the radiative modes of gravitational field, which are all encoded in a connection, and then the symplectic, covariant symplectic formulation, exactly the way that Bob was talking about. So in the 80s, it was shown that, in fact, these can be actually obtained. The Bondi formula can be obtained using those covariant Hamiltonian methods that Bob just referred to. Okay, so this is all very nice. And then, of course, we also have, as I said already, the BMS group has a certain nice structure. It also admits a preferred four-dimensional translational subgroup. And if NAB is equal to 0, then the bond, if there is no news, then it reduces the Poincaré group. And then these structures are used very routinely in quantum theory. For example, for talking about the Hawking radiation, we need to construct the Hilbert spaces of states here on scry minus and scry plus, and they are all used using this time translation, this translation group. Similarly, we can actually talk about for zero response fields in full exact general relativity, we can talk about mass and spin using the BMS group. So all these are beautiful. You understand it extremely well, and it has been around for so long and used in numerical relativity and gravitational waves and so on and so on. However, none of this structure goes over to the case when we have got a positive cosmological constant. We do not have even a basic notion. We don't know what Bondi news means. We don't have balanced law. We don't have positive energy or flux. Positive energy theorems were seminal in, you know, in both for physics and mathematics, and we don't have any of that. And we don't even know how to say there is no incoming radiation. We don't know what gravitational waves mean in full nonlinear general relativity, however small the positive cosmological constant is. And in quantum theory, we don't have positive and negative frequency decomposition in asymptotically, not de Sitter, but asymptotically de Sitter spacetimes. And therefore, we don't know how to construct the S-metric state. Okay. So this is really shocking, right? I mean, this is pretty shocking. And so that's what I want to talk about. So first of all, I want to say why this is the case. So half the talk is going to be about these problems. And then I'll tell you some recent work that is, I have been thinking about them almost for 2 years now. And I'll tell you part of the results is just to give you a flavor of things. OK. So asymptotically de Sitter spacetimes, I wrote down the definition just for those people in the audience who are experts in this, see what it is. It's exactly the same definition as Penrose has given in the case of the asymptotically flat spacetime. The only difference is that we put a positive cosmological constant up here. And instead of scry is usually, the topology is S2 cross R for asymptotically flat spacetime. Now it is S3, or if you have stars and so on, then minus some punches. But apart from that, the definition is exactly the same. We say spacetime is asymptotically de Sitter if it admits a conformal completion with a conformal factor satisfying the standard conditions, the field equations holding, and the stress energy tensor falling off sufficiently fast. These are all standard conditions. Nothing is being changed up here. So what changes? What changes is that if we have zero cosmological constant, then scry is null. And it is ruled by null geodesics. So we've got an extra structure there, namely this ruling by this null geodesics. So I got a cylinder, and that cylinder is ruled. And therefore, asymptotic symmetries have to also map this ruling. And therefore, there's an extreme rigidity, which gives us the BMS group and everything. In the asymptotically de Sitter case, scry, as you know, is space-like. And if you have space-like scry, the normal to it is just perpendicular. It's not. So we don't have any ruling here. We just have a three-dimensional surface. And because of that, the standard BMS construction just doesn't work anymore. And therefore, the asymptotic symmetry group, in absence of this ruling, is that asymptotically symmetric group is just the diffeomorphism group of scry. And therefore, I don't know what I mean by time translation, space translation, rotation, or super translation, or anything. And therefore, I don't know what I mean by energy and linear momentum, angular momentum, et cetera. Using this covariant phase space formulation, out of the space of solutions to Einstein's equation, you could define these quantities if you knew what they are supposed to generate, a time translation, a space translation, asymptotically, and we don't have any of those things. And that is the problem. So just to go on again, contrast de Sitter and Minkowski space. This is the standard Penrose diagram of Minkowski space that you have seen many, many, many times. And this is the de Sitter space. I got scry minus and scry plus, which is space-like. And as you know, there are these cosmological horizons. And what I would usually mean by time translation vector field up here, that actually looks like this vector field up here. And therefore, in particular, in the neighborhood of scry minus or scry plus, the vector field is actually space-like. In fact, because scry is space-like, And just by construction, it is true that every killing vector field must be tangential to Scry. Therefore, all vector fields, all killing vector fields of De Sitter are in fact space-like near Scry. And that will also be the true for asymptotically De Sitter space-times. And now what happens with that? Well, the point is that if you have got a space-like killing vector field, then the associated constant quantity can have any sign, and it is completely unbounded. You know, it is like having momentum in Minkowski space, right? If you just want to calculate momentum of a field in Minkowski space, take the stress energy tensor and calculate, plug in a killing field, integrate, get a momentum, and that momentum can be either positive or negative. Same thing happens here. So here, energy can be of a Maxwell field in De Sitter, or Klein-Gordon field in De Sitter, the energy can be arbitrarily positive, can be arbitrarily large and positive as usual, but also can be arbitrarily large and negative. And this is irrespective of how small lambda is. Okay? So therefore, at the moment, it sort of looks shocking because I don't feel, I mean, I would not have something like a positive energy theorem because the generator is space-like up here, what am I going to do, and so on. So these are the questions that I think when I realized it a couple of years ago, I was totally shocked that the subject is sort of so completely wide open in the positive cosmological constant case, whereas, as you all know here better than me, in the negative cosmological constant case, one understands a lot. Okay. So now here is another question that I will just point out. Namely, we have here a black hole space-time. And this is just a classical extension of the black hole space-time that in the standard, there is a white hole and there is a black hole. If you can start in this region, you take the maximal analytical extension, and you'll get this space-time, as you all know. So what happens with the eternal black hole of the positive cosmological constant? So if you just start with it to begin with, then you've got sort of, if you like, you know, this Scry just gets lifted up, this Scry gets lifted up, and becomes space-like. I got a singularity, except that now I can continue. Here, this is the maximal analytical extension. Here, I can just continue. And so what I would like to talk about is, so to say, a single white hole, black hole pair. How do I do that? Well, in the literature, what one does is just makes an notices that it is very nice that we can do an identification. There is actually an isometry. I can just identify this surface to this surface. And then I don't have to go ahead. I can just stop here, up here. This is how what one means by eternal black hole. But notice that here, the topology of a space like which your surface up here is going to be S2 cross R, whereas it is going to be here, each point is S2, but because of identification, it is S2 cross S1. So well, this is fine, you know, we can do this, there's no problem. But what happens with a collapsing star? This is the kind of thing we would like to talk about in Hawking radiation. Now I'm in trouble, because over here I identified this point, this line with this line. Now, I mean, either I had to put another star in order to get an isometry, which one could, but that's not what one is interested in. One is interested in single star collapsing, forming a black hole. And now the statement is, what do I do? Because here, if I just stop here, I get a time-like boundary up here. So I cannot really give you the initial state of Scry minus, because information will be coming in from here. So all these are sort of obvious and rather puzzling and annoying questions, and these have been open. So this is what I wanted to tell you in the conceptual setting. Now what about going back to the first thing? Right. No, you can add another matter there. That's right. I mean, in fact, numerical simulations have been done that with two stars collapsing and everything. I agree with that. But I'm interested in single boundary. I want to know what happens. Then there is an issue. But you are completely right. I mean, Tarkovsky's group, not Tarkovsky, Shapiro's group has not done numerical simulations. Okay. Now I want to go back to this issue about gravitational waves and constant quantities and so on, and the natural question then is, can we strengthen the boundary condition at Scry so that instead of diffeomorphism of group, we have some good group where we can talk about translations and rotations and so on. And there's a natural strategy which is commonly used in the literature. Namely, we have this definition which I showed before, but let us strengthen the definition by asking that the three metric on Scry, the intrinsic metric on Scry, should be conformally flat. Now, if you ask this, this is a strengthening of the boundary condition, looks natural. And not only is the symmetric group reduced, but it is reduced to the sitter, because the conformal isometric group of a three-dimensional plus 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 signature is precisely the de Sitter group. And that's great. Now we've got the de Sitter group, so everything is good. Now we can define charges as like the bondy mass associated with every cross-section. I can take the asymptotic electric part of the Weyl tensor, plug it into the Killing vector field, and evaluate this. You get the expected answers in curved de Sitter, so everything looks good. So this is a good strategy, it looks like. And so the problems I talked about for gravitational waves and positive energy and so what is energy and so on could perhaps be alleviated. But there are two serious problems. So this is a strategy that is often used, but there are two serious problems. The first is that conformal flatness of scry, which is also true for anti-de Sitter, implies that the magnetic part of the Weyl tensor is zero on scry. Now in the anti-de Sitter case, you've got sort of a time-like boundary, and you need a boundary condition to get a well-posed initial value problem, and this is perfectly fine. Now I got a space-like boundary, and if I ask that the magnetic part be zero, it is heuristically clear that you're throwing away half the solutions. But even worse, one can say, okay, I throw away half the solution, I will live with it. What happens? Well, what happens is that when you do that, well, it turns out that when you calculate this quantity, QC of C, these 10 quantities associated with the 10 de Sitter symmetries, they're absolutely conserved. There is no gravitational leakage through gravitational waves at all. So in Minkowski space, you have got some star which is doing this, radiating. We calculate this conserved charge, which Gary and Malcolm Perry proved is positive. I can calculate the conserved charge up here, that's again positive. You take the difference, and the balance law says is given by the energy which went away, went through here. Here, if I take any two cross sections, I will find the conserved charge to be the same, even though there is kind of half these degrees of freedom are still there and there's radiation. I would find that, in fact, that there is no, the gravitational waves don't carry any energy, don't carry any angular momentum, and everything. And no matter how tiny the cosmological constant, the limit is discontinuous. That is the point. Because it is always space-like, no matter how small the cosmological constant is, and becomes null in the limit. You can show it in many, many ways. You have to be very, very careful to take this limit. Okay. So what we can do is, the second part of the talk, I can just say that, well, this is all, you know, pretty complicated. So why don't we just take some intuition from linearized gravity? Now, this part of the program is complete. It's being written up, so I can just summarize what is happening. So what happens in this case? Because in the linearized case, we get a lot of intuition, which we can then carry over to the full case. So in the case, so we look at linearized electromagnetic waves or gravitational waves. I'm focusing on gravitational waves here. And so we can do that. And then in the case lambda bigger than zero, the following results we already have. Namely, there is explicit consequence of this condition BAB equal to zero. What does it really mean? We'll see what it means in a minute. This also makes contact with cosmological investigation, because we're interested in gravitational waves, the cosmological models, so we can look at that. Then we have expressions for energy, momentum, and angular momentum, with these fluxes carried by the gravitational waves. And then even though the energy in general can be arbitrarily negative, we'll see why physically it is always positive. In a physical situation, it's always positive. And therefore that tells us, that suggests some conjecture in the full theory for positive energy theorem is going to be harder than the lambda equal to zero case, but still this nice conjecture that we can talk about. Okay, so let me start with the first condition. Let's see what happens when we talk about BAB equal to zero condition. So I'm talking about the de Sitter space time, so I got scry minus, scry plus, and I'm going to just restrict my attention to the Poincaré patch. We'll see later that this is the right thing to do for full general relativity as well. So let me just look at the Poincaré patch up here. So these are the conformal time or any proper time equal to constant surfaces up here. And so the metric is just written like that. And you can see again here that the cosmological constant is in the, sorry, the h is in the denominator. So when lambda goes to zero, h goes to infinity. And if I take a naive limit, I'll just get zero on the right-hand side. That shows that you have to take the limit properly, right? I mean, you cannot just write a metric in any coordinates, keep this coordinates the same, and take a limit. What you have to do is to use the proper time in x, y, and z, and then there's no problem in taking lambda going to zero limit.
Okay. So linearized gravitational waves. So there are two kinds of modes, as everybody knows, that are so-called growing mode and a decaying mode. So you can solve. So first of all, I can look at the, because I got spatial flatness, I can do Fourier transforms, and I got just k's, right? And this is the momentum, this is the norm of the k, and I get a specific time dependence times e to the rk dot x, and specific time dependence times this. So these are the two independent modes. Scribe plus and corresponds to eta equal to 0. So therefore, you can see that this mode goes to 0 on scribe plus. That's why it's called decaying mode. And this mode, on the other hand, does not go to 0 on scribe plus because there's a cross here. And it's called growing mode, but it just has a limit on scribe. It's not growing. So we got these two kinds of modes up here. Now what happens is the following. If dAd is equal to 0, these coefficients are purposely chosen because this mode completely determines what the electric part of the white dancer is, and this mode completely determines what the magnetic part of the white dancer is. Okay. In other words, the general solution is a linear combination, but what determines the electric part is just this, the decaying mode, and what determines the magnetic part is the growing mode. So if I put magnetic part equal to 0, that implies that B must be 0 up here. It's a calculation I'm telling you. And therefore, I got only this mode, which is actually going to 0 here. Okay. So you can see here explicitly that BAB equal to 0 really rules out half the number of degrees of freedom as we are suspected, and you're left with only the decaying mode, which is 0 at scrum. What about the set of momentum fluxes? And here, these were calculated. I'm really glad that Bob spoke before me. These were calculated using the covariant phase space formulation that you talked about, exactly by using the symplectic structure with the d derivative of x, where x is a symmetric vector field. The reason why we want to do that is because, as we all know, that there is no Stresemann tensor associated with gravitational waves, but the Hamiltonian methods still work, covariant Hamiltonian methods. I don't draw too much distinction between the covariant Hamiltonian methods and Lagrangian methods. So anyway, so this actually does work, and we get explicit formulae for Maxwell field, or Klein-Gordon field, or any other field. You get, of course, the standard results. But here, we don't need a Stresemann tensor. So so we calculate this formula up here. And what happens, you can express it in terms of the perturbation and the electric part. This, for technical reasons, you all probably know that the wild tensor is actually 0 on scry, and therefore what you have to do is to take omega to the minus 1 times the wild tensor. So when I say electric part, I mean electric part of that object, which is often called KABCD, which has a well-defined limit at scry. So the nice thing is that the symplectic structure, so this is not the current, but the total symplectic structure, which includes the integral up here, is just given by the h times e prime, so I got two linearized solutions, minus h prime times e, the same kind of formula that Bob had. So e, if you like, is a canonically conjugate momentum corresponding to this h up here, the electric part of the wild tensor. And then you calculate the corresponding Hamiltonians, corresponding to the De Sitter symmetry, and the energy defined by De Sitter time translation Ta turns out to be, most of you might see it immediately, it is of the type EAB times lead derivative of this vector field of this h with respect to t. But then for the energy, there's also an extra term because this at scry, we're writing everything in the conformal frame so that it is well defined even at scry. And at scry, the divergence of this vector field is not 0. The vector field is tangential, but its divergence is not 0. So there's an extra term up here that comes. Okay, so you get a well-defined formula for what the energy or momentum or angular momentum carried away by gravitational fields. Again, if BAB is equal to 0, then we just saw there is no growing mode. Therefore, H is just 0 on scry. Therefore, this is 0, this is 0. And therefore, the whole Hamiltonian vanishes. So in other words, the last transparency, what we saw was that half the number of degrees of freedom are thrown away. This is thrown away, you're just left with this. So you might think, OK, I will live with that and see what I get for the energy for that. And the statement is that, as we saw in the full theory, here too, the energy, momentum, angular momentum, et cetera, also vanish. So these degrees of freedom do not carry any fluxes. So now finally, the properties of this energy up here. Now, we saw that
we saw that I was telling you that the flux is actually arbitrarily positive and arbitrarily negative. It is unbounded above and unbounded below up here. Why is that? Because I got a killing vector here. I'm looking at the Poincaré patch. I got a killing vector field here, and that killing vector field is actually a future-directed timeline. So you would imagine that if I got a Cauchy surface, then whatever fields are in this region would contribute positively to the energy. But then here, the killing vector field becomes space-like. Therefore, I cannot control the sign. It is easier to look at the horizon. Here, the killing vector field is future-directed, and here, the killing vector field is past-directed. So here, the energy would be positive. Here, the energy would be negative. And therefore, supposing I had, for example, a source which is emitting gravitational waves. And for example, we have worked out the quadruple formula, and this is what happens with that. So we got these gravitational waves coming out. Now, in this case, you would want no incoming radiation. So there should be no radiation coming in here. Everything is just emitted by this thing. So no incoming radiation means that there is no radiation coming in here at all. All that is, so over here, I got nothing coming in. I had something going out up here. But in this region, the killing vector field is time-like, and therefore the total energy is positive. So you would expect the same thing to be true in full general relativity, that if I put no incoming radiation condition up here, and if I actually had some source emitting gravitational waves, I would expect the energy emitted to be positive in that case also. So that would be a good thing to show. But as you can see here, it's very non-local, because you have to really make sure that there is no incoming radiation here at sky minus, or at the past horizon up here. Right. So but this is the reason why I'm looking at upper region, because ultimately, as we'll see in the next class. Yeah, I should. We don't want the bottom. So that's why the no incoming boundary condition is really here. In this case, it is a puncture sphere, yes. Exactly. It's punctured over here because of the image charge, but it's not physically. I mean, you're right. So, yeah. And therefore, in this case, the topology is going to be equal to S2 cross R, because that's a topology that will. Okay? Instead of S3 up here, in this case. I could fill in with the star, but what happens is that you really cannot, because it really is a puncture. The reason is because the conformal completion puts all this into a single point up here, and therefore at that point the field should not be regular. We'll talk about it. And now finally we have got this explicit formula for the energy, and we can ask the following. Supposing there were actually a formula for the energy and momentum and so on in the full theory somehow, then compatibility would require that if I took a second order linearization of it, I would get this flux formula. So is there such a formula? And the answer is yes, that in fact, so it provides us guidance. The formula that I was writing down before could be used. Their second order linearization uses exactly the last formula that I wrote down. But what would happen is that if you had this in full general relativity, then on sky plus up here, you would not have the sitter. You would not have this killing vector fields. So this thing would not be a conformal killing vector field of the physical metric. It would be some symmetry which is singled out by some appropriate considerations. And therefore, this quantity is not conserved. And therefore, the quantity here and quantity here would be different. And the flux that will be carried away is exactly that the energy, that the gravitational waves, which actually go in between. So now I just want to conclude with the strategy for the full long linear theory. This is a very long story, so I don't have time to talk about yeah, 5 minutes, okay, good. So the strategy to construct the theory using cosmological, the strategy is the following. As Don just pointed out, we don't want to have sky minus at all. We just want to look at this upper part of this diagram up here. Again, I just somehow don't have the proper the figure here. This should have been red and not this. So this should be right up here, and this is the part of space-time that I'm going to be looking at up here. And now I got these waves coming out up here, you know, like that. So one strategy is to just look at this part up here, and then the key point is the following. We want no incoming radiation. So how are we going to impose this condition? So the idea is that you have got some isolated system, therefore these sources define some point on sky minus. This point will be little i minus and little I plus up here. These sources will define these points up here. I look at the cosmological horizon of it, and I want to think of this as being the local or the relevant piece of spark analog of sky minus. This is what I will look at. Okay? And then the statement is that we would like to impose suitable boundary conditions. And it turns out that there was a lot of work that was done already, which had to do with weakly isolated horizons in the context of black hole mechanics. Again, to get the laws of black hole mechanics, they were also obtained using the covariant phase space modulation, exactly like Bob pointed out. This is supposed to be a weakly isolated horizon. You can check the symmetric group of the weakly isolated horizon, and it's similar. It's infinitely dimensional with a normal structure like the BMS group. It's very, very nice. Okay, but in particular, you have a notion of time translation, therefore we can talk about energy, et cetera, et cetera. So this is one program. And the other program is to say that, well, let's not even look at sky plus up at all. In fact, you know, what I would like to really look at is this triangle, and observationally, as you probably intuitively see, this is the triangle that is going to be relevant. So here I'm going to not only use all of the horizon, I'm just going to use this bit of the horizon. What is this bit? This is, I just look here and I plus, and I look at the past horizon of I plus, okay? So this in space-time would look like the future horizon, this would look like this in the past, and this in the future. So we just look at this triangle up here. If you do that, then addition of this extra point actually reduces the group just to four-dimensional group, one time translation and three space rotation. And then using this bifurcated horizon, you can actually lift the symmetries up H plus. So the physical metric here is not going to be invariant under these symmetries. The physical geometry up here is invariant under the symmetries, no incoming radiation. But there is sort of say, this is sort of say the kinematical structure. This would be the geometry that would be there had there been no radiation. So we've got a fiducial structure up here which defines for us some symmetries. And now again, we've got outgoing radiation, so we would like to write down formulae for body energy, body momentum, etc. And that is what we do. So again, this was a picture in asymptotically flat space-time, and now we're one strategy that I'm talking about because of time, I'm just going to mention one strategy. This is the part that I'm going to be looking at. Now, for the problem with the gravitational collapse and the Hawking radiation and so on, now I don't even have to worry about other star or something. I can just give you the incoming state here, and I'll give you the outgoing state here. I do have a symmetry here, which is the time translation symmetry, which tells me how to do positive and negative frequency decomposition. This symmetry has been lifted here as a kinematical symmetry. I use that to do positive and negative frequency decomposition. And as you can see, this picture is very similar to the picture we have in ordinary black hole evaporation. And therefore, we could do this calculation. This details of this calculation have not been done, but it is clear that you know, one can just do this calculation without any problem. Okay. Now, just last thing that I wanted to mention was that we also have formulae for what would be what would be the charge integral written here and written here. These formulae are sort of well motivated, and I just want to flash it so that you have a visual sort of impression of what happens. You again have psi 2, and now you get, instead of having just the shear of one of the null normals to scry, you get shears of both null norm, or sorry, one normal at the horizon up here, the normal n. You also have a shear of L up here. You also have expansions up here. But you can check that this formula in the limit, when you go to Minkowski space, asymptotically flat space, you can take the limit very carefully and very systematically. Just gives you the standard formula that we have for the bonding charge that is in the literature. So there's a candidate up here. Well, look, you can also look at fluxes coming from this formulae, and we can do and analyze them. This work is still sort of being looked at, and from various checks are being carried out for this particular formulae. And the question is, of course, ultimately going to be under the other physical conditions that we talked about, which is that there is no incoming radiation here. Is this
are these integrals positive, what happens, etc. You could also do similar construction as chi plus, and then the open issues would be the relating what happens at chi plus to what happens on this horizon. As far as issues having to do with gravitational waves and radiation and such things are concerned, or numerical relativity, this might be is better suited for some general conceptual reasons. It might be, this picture it seems to be better suited. So I'll tell you the advantages and the merits and demerits if there is interest. Okay, let me summarize now. Okay. For positive cosmological constant, literature is focused primarily on chi plus and chi minus, assuming conformally invariant intrinsic geometry. But if you assume that the intrinsic metric is conformally flat, then, sorry, conformally flat intrinsic geometry, but if you make that assumption, then the magnetic part of the Y tensor is zero, and the linearized assumption, linearized calculation to tell us that in this case, you really are throwing away half the degrees of freedom in a very explicit manner. And furthermore, it is ill-suited to study the gravitational radiation in full general relativity and also for quantum considerations because of this picture that we just saw up here. It is looking at chi minus and chi plus is not so well-suited. So instead, the idea is instead of having this picture, what we want to do is to focus on this picture or this picture. In both those cases, you have these difficulties we have seem to be avoided, and you will be able to get a good theory, both classically and quantum mechanically. So inclusion of lambda, however small, introduces qualitatively new conceptual issues, and the examples were the sky, and hence all the symmetry vector fields there are space-like. Therefore, energy can be arbitrarily negative. An extra time-like boundary can appear in the case of the gravitational collapse, changing the S-matrix paradigm, and there is no peeling at chi minus, making it difficult to impose the no incoming radiation condition, etc. And the hope is that where explicit work in the linearized theory is understood, there is a quadruple moment form, the quadruple formula has been generalized, and now the finishing touches are being put on the full theory. The quantum issues are just beginning to be explored. Thank you.
So can you boil water with gravity into Sitter space?
Yes.
Thank you.
What about chicken soup? No. What I wanted to ask is, in this last few slides when you were imposing, I guess, that the past horizon or whatever, the past initial conditions are a weakly isolated horizon.
Right.
Would it be enough to impose that on the portion of it that's in the future of the intersection with H plus?
Yeah. So there is a
because that would allow you to consider a much larger class of systems. Right. Your star would not have to be infinitely stable towards the past.
You're talking about H plus?
Yeah. I'm asking when you impose the weakly isolated horizon condition on H minus.
Right.
Why not just do it in the upper half of H minus? I mean, why do you care?
Oh, because we don't want incoming. I mean, I understand. Sorry. So we could impose it here, is what you're saying. But the statement is that, just like in Minkowski space, I hope. In Minkowski space, one imposes the no incoming boundary conditions here as well, because we want to calculate what is going out to infinity, and we would like to have no incoming physically, no incoming boundary conditions also completely here. So that corresponds to imposing no incoming boundary conditions up here, because we're just interested in what went out, not what came in and then that was scattered off here. For the things like Hawking effect or asymptotic Hilbert spaces, if I don't impose isolated horizon boundary condition here, I would not have a preferred some boundary condition here, isolated horizon boundary, then I would not have a preferred time translation vector field. I would not know what I mean by positive negative frequency decomposition. After all, this surface is right in the middle of this sort of space time.
It seems like this construction is naturally adapted to what we would usually refer to as the flat slicing of De Sitter space. And it seems like there should be a sensible story for the global slicing. And it looks like what do you think is the answer for the global slicing? It looks like your story doesn't extend to that case, but we could, should be able to.
As far as linearized analysis is concerned, we can do it for the global slicing, there's no problem. I mean, the global De Sitter space at all.
Okay.
Here I was presenting the linearized case as a motivation or as a prelude to the full theory. In the full theory, I do think that, in fact, you like just this portion or just this portion, which you would say is a complete patch or smaller than that.
But are you saying then that there shouldn't be a sensible description of the in the full nonlinear theory of the global De Sitter evolution, or what are you saying?
I'm drawing a big distinction between De Sitter, which is one space time, and you can do test fields on it, you can do all kinds of mathematics on it, and so on.
Yes.
And gravitational fields with a positive cosmoid constant. I'm talking
good. About okay. Yeah. So De Sitter plus perturbation. So I should have something like De Sitter with say a big sphere asymptotically, far in the past, some excitations on it, and then that can go through the throat of the minimal contraction if there is not too much energy, and then go out and.
Right.
So does that not make sense?
So that again, there are two. Just to cover that, there are two points here. The first is just looking at the existence and uniqueness, and evolution is well defined and so on. And the statement is that in fact Helmut Friedrich proved it before the Kleinemann-Christodoulou result for lambda equal to zero. For lambda positive, he proved in fact that you can exactly do what you said. You can give yourself some initial data here, but no sources, just the initial data here, and you can evolve, and in fact you get global for small data, you get global existence, and then there is no problem.
Right.
The second problem is extracting physics from this result. I would like to talk about energy, momentum, balance laws, conserved quantities, positive, negative frequency decomposition, etc. I don't know how to do any of that in the global picture.
Okay.
And there are no ideas in literature how to do that.
Okay. I just had one comment and one question. The comment is, I highly agree with you about setting boundary conditions on scry as being a bad thing. One other bad thing that happens to that is that it would make the tensor power spectrum equal to zero if you set the BAB equal to zero, and that's the one thing that has some phenomenological application to it, so I highly endorse that. The other question is, have you thought about the issue, or has anybody thought about the issue of looking at doing these things in more general cosmologies, that is, where you had first slow roll parameter not equal to zero?
Yes. So it was done in fact slightly more generally, which is putting dust and radiation and also in the De Sitter phase where the slow roll parameter is not necessarily equal to zero and so on. So this, I don't want to say that every detail was worked out, but most of this thing was very worked out for the linearized case, for linearized fields propagating. First of all, for the background, being asymptotic anti-De Sitter and the study of linearized fields. So, we can talk about it. If you have specific questions, I can tell you what. For the linearized case, those kind of issues have been understood. So, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, I also have a comment and a question, a comment to Jim's question that you might be able to boil water with gravity waves in De Sitter space, but you won't be able to make tea with it because all the points on scribe plus are out of causal contact. And my second question is more technical, which is, can you write down a symplectic form for the, did you write an expression for that? Maybe you did. On H plus?
For this, I just looked at the form that I wrote down was in terms of the, this expression is gauge invariant, and if we want on H plus.
Does something good happen to it? Is it simplifying H plus?
It's already
You can't simplify okay. more than that. So it's sort of electric part of the wild, I mean, you get the analog of the electric part of the wild tensor, which, you know, is sort of a very transparent and has all kinds of things on normal scry that we all looked at in great detail. And then we get the linearized perturbation there. So okay. so it is the same formula that will be valid. Maybe I should write it in terms of the forms, in which case it will become explicit that you can just evaluate it anywhere you want. But, so.
I was just wondering if you could recover the missing mode by multiplying by appropriate scale factor and then taking the limit.
Right. So if you did that, but of course then the mode will not satisfy the field equations anymore.
Well, no, I mean, the mode is the mode. I'm just saying be able to be just sensitive to it. So you could pick it up
right,
that way.
Right, right. So the statement is that you could just take it and multiply it by an appropriate power of scale factor, and then you'll see it there. But the formula for that, it still does not carry any energy, because that what appears here is just H, not the appropriate power of the scale factor.
So I wanted to ask a question about positivity for the nonlinear theory. So for the linear theory, this idea of imposing, you know, what you call the weakly isolated horizon boundary condition is great. I can see why it should work. I'm happy. But if we're talking about extending this to nonlinear case, I don't think I even know what that means. And I'm curious if you have a thought here, but my confusion is especially that in the nonlinear case, we expect that when we perturb the sitter, that horizon pinches off and goes to the origin and collapses, so that if you have an isolated horizon boundary condition, presumably the space-time is just empty. And I don't know what to do. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You mean?
What would be
the past horizon pinches?
The past horizon, yeah. What kind of condition in the nonlinear theory would you impose to end up with a positive conserved quantity? Defining the conserved quantity, I think I understand how to do.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, this is going to be, yeah. So you mean, how do I put the condition like a no incoming boundary condition up here?
Yeah, what does it mean?
I think, maybe we should talk more about it, because I'd like to understand cases where it actually this doesn't exist.
Well, it exists, but Bob and Wald and Gao showed that generically, it doesn't.
Yeah, so we have looked at that in some detail.
I have to just
recall again. So the statement is that in this case, in other words, does it exist long enough, right? I mean, for the, there are two things. One is we would like to have, does it exist long enough so that this actually, this horizon meets it. So in other words, does this make sense? I mean, it might pinch up here.
I was thinking about the sort of, if you like, the inflating patch case where you were just tracing the horizon back from future infinity. But I'm also confused about this case where you just have the left wedge.
Right. So I think that what I was talking about with this positive thing is really more likely clearer in this case, right? I mean, namely, okay. We just have work with this patch up here. So you got a horizon up here, the future of this I minus that is coming up here. And we would have to look at those space-times for which are the property that if I look at the past of this, the past horizon of this, it intersects. And the statement is that the detailed equations show that if you have weakly isolated horizon boundary conditions appear, there is no obstruction for this to happen. But there may be more subtle thing that we'll have to worry about. And then the statement is that really I would think that the energy up here is what where I would talk about positive energy. So I'm talking about this particular. So for example, in that case, so you can rewrite the formula for the energy that was on the last transparency, this formula up here. You can rewrite in a very nice way in terms of just the areas of the cross sections of the future horizon and the time rate of change of that cross section of the future horizon. And this is always positive. It's a usual surprising thing, as in fact, the mass is leaving, the area of this horizon actually increases. This is always positive. So if in fact it is the case that if we could show that under some nice physical conditions, the radius of this horizon at the future boundary, if you could show that the radius of this horizon at the future up here is always less than the cosmological radius, that is something that, under some conditions one might be able to show. So if that is the case, then the statement is that that formula will be positive. The explicit formula we have will be positive. If this quantity is less than 1, then this formula will be positive. So the question is whether we can actually prove such things under good physical conditions about, yeah.
Okay, I have some more questions, but I think I should say them.
Sure.
Okay, so let's thank Abhay and Bob again.